Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1120.1K2248, certificate number 9795. Sea peoples. Like sea monkeys?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, as far as we know.
Little comic book ad, I'm going to grow some sea people.
This is one of those topics that I've been wanting to do for a decade. The entire decade that we've been doing this show.
We've only been doing this show 5 years, I think, right? Six?
I think it's 2017, late 2017.
It's like December 2017.
Well, but still, it's 2017. We're not Koreans. It's not like the whole... Maybe I said that wrong. Maybe if we were Koreans...
I'm more Korean than you.
It would be a whole year.
Our first show came out on, December 7th, 2017, Pearl Harbor Day.
A day that will live in infamy for two reasons now.
So fine, 6.5 years.
Yeah, that's a long time. So, and for most of that time, I've been wanting to do this show, but it is such a sprawling story
A real saga?
Yeah, it's
a real epic?
It's pre-epic, even. But I'm going to truncate it by really not naming any of the major players and just sort of giving giving this story in broad strokes.
So, no proper names.
Yeah, so don't give me a bunch of your questions about who exactly said what.
So this is the opposite of an AI summary. This is Sea Peoples : The Vibes edition.
That's exactly right. Well, who I'm not naming... Because a lot of the story, as we know, of Western history,
you did woke quotes. Thank you.
Sort of small woke quotes because I, it's like what else do we have?
And you have arthritis.
Just a minute ago, I was like, what do they call the white broccoli?
You just asked me, what do you call the white broccoli?
And you were like, do you mean? I don't even remember what you said. Oh, you said cauliflower,
which is correct.
And I. But you said it with a look on your face like, oh my God, is this the first sign that you're having mini strokes and that you're old man now?
It just seems like incredibly stoned guy in a beanbag question. Do we have any more white broccoli?
What's white broccoli called again, brah? But this is, a lot of the things that we would have even 20 years ago, back when cultural anthropology was a thing, that we would have described as history— Now we're much more knowledgeable in the sense that we can talk about Western European history and not have it be history, because a lot of the transitions between Stone Age and Bronze Age and the Iron Age are things that I think during my entire education no one would have questioned what those things even meant. But that's a system of classification of history.
And it's kind of Eurocentric? Is that what you're saying? It's a little murkier now?
Well, yeah, because a lot of it is, the thing about the Stone Age is it basically is a term that encompasses 3.5 million years
of the Flintstones.
Of the Flintstones, right? And then there's the Bronze Age, which is really, you know, between 3300 BC and 1200 BC.
It's a lot shorter than the Stone Age.
It's a lot shorter. And then
do you think there'd be more than one TV show from the Stone Age, given the millions of years?
Yeah, but well, there is. What about Land of the Lost?
Yeah, there we go. That's not really the Stone Age, but okay.
And then, you know, the Iron Age, well, you know, started in 1300 BC and sort of went to the, went until the Steel Age or whatever, the Modern Age.
What do people say? Industrial Revolution? What's the end of the Iron Age?
No, I think, you know, the end of the Iron Age.
Or is there now like the Information Age starts with Gutenberg? Is that how we do it?
I think, you know, then you get into like the, well, what we'll be talking about, kind of the Archaic Age. And again, this is very Greek centric because yeah. Most of our written record starts during this sort of end of the Bronze Age period. And prior to that, there's not really very much writing. And you know, but this is, I think, part of the Eurocentrism, right? In China, there was writing, historical writing already, even before iron. So what we think of as the Iron Age and the historic record kind of coincide.
I feel like I came up in this weird kind of saddle period where it was all still taught the same way, like the Greeks this, the Greeks that, but then they would just have added a sentence like, and the Chinese actually had paper 1,000 years before that,
right?
Or you know, whatever it is. And the Chinese had also been there.
But like
the, as an asterisk.
A lot of this this cultural archaeology, really, it's only 19th century, and we've talked about it before. Like even the recognition of fossils, but it was really the French and the English and the Germans who were kind of first venturing out with science under their belt, sort of Enlightenment science, and going to places like Egypt and saying, "Oh, this isn't just." Stuff we shouldn't be taking these stones and building new buildings with them. We should actually look at this and try and figure out what the past represents. I mean, there are a lot of Egyptian sites from pre-history or from this period, Bronze Age, where the Byzantines would just build a church kind of right in the middle of Ramses III's burial temple. And then the French started coming in the 19th century, and then they kind of did in some cases, like a thing that we would look back and go, oh, lame, which was demolish all the Byzantine churches.
Because Napoleon had a thing for pharaohs.
Yeah, and it was like, oh, that doesn't belong here. We're going to take all that. And, you know, stuff that now we wish had been left alone, so it's part of
the French.
What we'd be interested in.
There goes the neighborhood.
But a lot of trying to codify a story about history, it was also a thought technology in 19th century and, you know, colonialist or proto-colonialist set of thought technologies. The idea of bronze and stone and iron ages was really sort of, it was an invention of a guy named C.J. Thompson.
And he was like, that's the main thing. Once you get bronze, the world changes.
Yeah, and it did for sure, because it changes war and it changes art and it changes, and what that does is change economics.
Yeah.
And
so there's no serious challenge to those as the big inventions. Nobody's going to be like, actually, it should be.
Well, they're all, they can be and should be and are now divided into 1,000 different little microcosms, right? I mean, the Iron Age kind of begins in the West in like Romania and Bulgaria, and it takes a long time for it to gradually find its way to encompass the whole Mediterranean. And bronze too, and there's different Bronze Ages. There's I mean, once tools start to be cast rather than forged, that enables there to be larger armies and more stuff. And so casting bronze and forging bronze represent different ages.
Yeah, and people might have seen, I was at a natural history museum or a history museum in Copenhagen earlier in the summer. And it's just shocking how early they'll be like, yeah, here are some Roman coins that we found here. Yeah. You know, like before you would have thought anybody from, or, you know, Greek, here's some Greek stuff. You wouldn't have thought there was that much Mediterranean ship traffic heading up to Denmark.
Right.
But apparently the people there would have seen some of this material. They had no way of, they had no technology to reproduce.
And that, I think the in Scandinavia, the Iron Age lasted all the way up until 900 AD. I'm sorry, the Bronze Age. Mm. And it was really was the transition to the Vikings, right? So that's a lot later than, you know, what would be 1200 BC when iron first started really making its way into, I mean, you don't think of the Egyptian kingdoms as being iron consuming cultures. And, you know, you're mostly right, right? So, but what we're talking about now is this transition period between the end of the Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age. So it's in the couple hundred years around 1200 AD. And for most of the Bronze Age, the things that bronze enabled and the way that various different peoples sort of formed empire, it represented, and again, sort of pre-written history, all of these cultures that we know primarily from the epic tales of the Greeks, looking back, when you think about the Homeric sagas, mm-hmm. right, they're talking about prehistory. These are stories about...
Yeah, they're not talking about the thing that happened 20 years ago in Troy.
Yeah, it's not reportage.
Yeah.
It's the legends. And really the Bible is talking about a lot of legends that we only have written record of through either hieroglyphics, which were not really complete stories, or songs. And so, you know,
I think on a lot of these things, there's consensus, but no real proof of like when the stories actually were told. Like, I think Bible scholars now think that a lot of the patriarchal stuff from Genesis was told at a certain period of time, thousands of years later, you know, as an retrospective origin story in the face of, I don't know, the Babylonians maybe, or something like that. But the documents don't come with any evidence of how old the story is or what times it's even describing.
Yeah. And I mean,
it's fragmentary, very fragmentary.
Primary among some of that stuff are the like we were saying, the Trojan Wars, where the archaeological evidence for Troy is fairly recently. I mean, very recently was there even identified like a place that plausibly could have been Troy. And then our archaeology sort of confirmed, like, this kind of does. It
matches
fits
up.
It fits the bill. But then trying to decide when abouts there could have been a Trojan War, that date has shifted quite a bit recently, until it now is generally accepted to be placed kind of right in the middle of where our story is.
And sometimes those dates, they can shift like 1,000 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like...
Several hundred.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, was it in this decade or that decade?
But what all of the historic record and archaeological record, really everything that we know about the history of the West, from Persia to Paris, let's say
you're just going to stop at Paris?
Persia to Paris.
Persia to Portugal... Also has the alliteration.
Yeah, Persia to Portugal.
But it implies anything important was happening in Portugal.
There really wasn't a Paris. Let's just get to that.
Yeah.
What do they say from from Gaza to, and I'm talking about Gaza City, which is an ancient town.
Yeah, it's in the story of Samson.
All the way to
the shores of Tripoli.
Pretty much of further even.
Probably not the halls of Montezuma though.
No, not yet to not the part halls of the story, but the entire Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. There was a cataclysm, a cultural cataclysm or cataclysm.
Culturclysm.
A culturclysm that happened during an incredibly short period, 50 years, from 1200 to 1150. Now, this is, again, this is the result of a bunch of French and British archaeologists in the mid-19th century trying to make sense of what they're finding. And so things move around. Evidence suggests various things. This is all still very controversial with modern scholars.
To this day.
To this day. But the other thing about modern scholars is that they love to disagree, not just with each other, but especially with 19th century scholarship. And
well, you're not going to publish by agreeing.
That's exactly right. And so there's a lot of nitpicking. There's a lot of like harumph harumphing. There's a lot of, well, that's true, except not over here. And so therefore that, you know, that discredits your whole theory. There's quite a bit of that. And that even started in the 19th century. But generally, between 1200 and 1150 BC, most of the Mediterranean city-states collapsed or were destroyed. And these city-states in 1200 were extremely sophisticated cultures and economies.
And they all disappeared at the same time?
Yes.
And it probably took people a while to reconstruct that and realize it was all happening at the same time.
A long time. Prior to 1200, it was an era of, you know, Mycenae, Babylon, the Hittite kingdoms, Egypt, Canaan. They all were sophisticated states that had what was called palace culture. And
P-A-L-A-C-E?
Palaces.
Uh-huh.
And palace culture is a way of describing, I mean, the palace in this case is a central government. And the income from large kind of empires all generally flowed toward the palace in the capital city. It was administered by bureaucrats.
So there is a monarch, but there's an apparatus too, right?
Yeah, and the apparatus is bigger than the monarch, right? There are...
It's not just a king with his getting stuff from his vassals, like in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, there are armies, right, that are funded by the state. There are kings, but it is a palace society. There are officials. There is there's a kind of a functioning and sophisticated economy, and those economies are trading with other economies to make and every one of these civilizations is independent from one another, right? The Hittites and the Egyptians are competing with one another. They don't share a common language, but they are contemporary states.
Can I picture Game of Thrones here?
Yeah. I mean,
I guess they're smaller cities. They're, you know, maybe we'd be surprised at the kind of mud buildings where this stuff is taking place.
No, these are this is by
palace culture, it's a real palace.
Yeah, these are monumental stone architectures.
Okay.
Game of Thrones is an Iron Age culture,
yeah,
and one that has kind of a hilarious, there's magic and also there's some technology that's like didn't quite exist. But in a lot of other ways, there are navies.
These are big organizations.
Yeah, it would be a recognizable, in a lot of ways, modern culture.
So if you think if I time traveled back, I wouldn't be like, wow, like this so-called empire is kind of crappy. It really would be like, hey, I'm in a old-timey epic movie.
It's not quite, I mean, it's not like maybe the Romans having sewers, but the degree of organization and building and, you know, cultural cohesion wouldn't really be seen again until the Greeks revived it. And that represented, I mean, and this is described as what the Greeks themselves thought of as the Greek Dark Ages. Prior to the Archaic Age, like the age of what is, you know, part of the legends of Greece, all is coming,
after
hundreds of years after this period.
So they don't really have any received memory of it.
Just in the form of, I mean, this is kind of where the legend of Atlantis is. We've really reconstructed the majority of these histories in the modern era. This didn't survive. I mean, the Greeks...
We know more about people who lived about it than people who lived 2,000 years closer to it.
Yeah, right.
Or more.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The gradual understanding that this had occurred took a long time for us in the, you know, from the mid-19th century to the present to unravel and figure out and really see firsthand in excavating, like, oh, this was an enormous city, and then there's all these burn marks and all this rubble that all dates to, like, remarkably the same time, and then that city's gone. Like, in a lot of cases, major, major cities just gone. Nothing survives of them.
And do you think we thought there was nothing there? Like, we just kind of, it goes against this kind of naive narrative of like Greek and a civilization kind of arising out of nothing.
Yeah.
It turns out there were predecessors nearby.
When we think of the biblical narratives of Babylon and Mycenae, and the Seleucids and so forth. Yeah. I mean, those ancient civilizations, which we all took to be the beginning of civilizations, were all the civilizations that rose up out of the ashes.
Oh, okay.
Of these older and, you know, much more sophisticated cultures.
But they're mystery unnamed cultures? Like, we don't...
Well, no, we know about them, and largely... A lot of the written record was only revealed to us when we found the Rosetta Stone and were able to translate hieroglyphics into actual sort of records. And the Egyptians were
they were around then.
Yeah, and the pharaohs really loved to depict themselves as the heroes of the story, but they kept pretty good records.
They were pretty isolationist, right? Like, in general, most Egyptian dynasties kind of kept to themselves. They kind of thought, hey, we're the greatest. No need to colonize or explore. We love to get gifts and tributes from those valleys over there, but...
The Egyptian civilization survived for thousands of years, so in the early parts, yes. But the Hittites, and, you know, Linear B also is a language that we translated as a result of the Rosetta Stone, and it existed in this time. and was lost. Linear B was lost during this period, like stopped being used.
I don't speak it.
Well, that's the thing.
Oh, you mean because of whatever these catastrophes were, that's why Linear B went away.
Yeah. Hmm. But the Hittites were and from Anatolia or from Turkey. They were also a powerful, powerful empire. And they started, I mean, Egypt and the Hittites vied for much larger control of the region. So at that point, Egypt couldn't afford to be isolationist anymore. And they often confronted each other in wars in the Sinai and in the Levant. So
in between.
Yeah. I mean, there were battle sites in Gaza, and the Gaza Strip was equidistant between these two empires, and they would choose to fight their battles there. So there were a lot of inscriptions of describing heroic fights that would that depicted the Hittites as a knowable and describable civilization. And Linear B also. But there's surprisingly little firsthand documentation of this, of these cultures, just because, I mean, and I'm talking about written documentation. Right. There's a lot of archaeological evidence for them.
But then you're just like extrapolating from pottery shards.
Pottery shards.
It's a lot harder than somebody telling you, boy, there was a great battle here. Here's how it started.
But, also, I mean, this is some of the stuff that you do see in Western museums, like this wonderful art, wall paintings, mosaics, and then bronze and gold and silver. I mean, working silver and gold predates the Bronze Age. Those were metals that already were understood to be workable. They're soft. Workable into art and so forth. I mean, in the Americas, there arguably wasn't really a Bronze Age, but gold and silver were prominently worked.
Yeah.
And those were, monumental, cultures with monumental architecture and very sophisticated city plans.
You can have an amazing stone city in the jungle without bronze.
Bronze. Yeah. I mean, what bronze does is enable you to really systematize, right? Like really build an economy that incorporates an agrarian society into a network where there are markets and large markets, like all of the fruit and vegetables come to a central location and then are dispersed.
Not because it's a commodity or a currency, but because of the kind of tools you can build with it?
Yeah, that's right. And you get city populations where the city itself isn't farming to support itself, but has an empire. The Persians have their own empire. Mesopotamia is
a series of people, right?
Yeah, I mean, Sumerians, Babylon, and everybody Babylon, else. I mean,
Akkadians,
and then prehistory Greece. And all of the islands in the Mediterranean, Crete, and so forth. They all have economies, and they all have palace cultures.
I want a palace culture.
Well, you're living in one.
I have a McMansion culture. I guess I don't get the palace.
Yeah,
but very few of the people back then did either.
We're in the we're in a palace culture, effectively. So in right around 1200. Egypt is our evidence for this, because they were the ones that kept the most graphic records. Egypt started to be assailed by shipborne armies. Assailed by sails. These armies came from across the sea and were not the Hittites. And were not the Mycenaeans.
None of the usual suspects.
None of the usual suspects. But sophisticated armies that were arriving not just as like soldiers, but really coming as part of what appeared to be an attempt to mass migrate. Ships with women and children and farming equipment.
Wow, those are not the kind of pirate ships I'm picturing if they're like the Mayflower.
And they're, you know, the soldiers are kind of piratical, but it's a confusing and somewhat overwhelming series of attacks that begin with Ramses II. So Ramses, there are 11 Ramses.
Ramseses.
And they all happen kind of during this period that we're describing from
1200 BC or so.
Well, a little before 1200 BC. Ramses I had a long reign. And then Ramses II is maybe one of the major documenters of this invasion of the Sea Peoples. And then in the next 100 years, there are 9 more Ramses.
Do we say BCE, by the way? Well, I never find myself using it out loud.
I don't. I mean, but before Common Era is BCE, and before Christ is what we are raised to think.
But the thing is, BCE just means, yeah, by Common Era, it's coincidentally Christ. It's
also before Christ and after Christ. But we're not saying Christ anymore because boo.
We need to put him back in Christmas.
Yeah. So I just say BC because I'm old, and you can translate that however you want.
I'm going to make a woke comic strip called BCE,
where the
cavemen do not, in fact, worship Jesus somehow.
Yeah, that was weird when BC went from being a funny comic to being a Christian polemical comic.
Yeah.
Like, and by funny, I mean lame.
How do these guys know what Easter is? It's a Stone Age.
They keep bowing down to a star. But it's taking place 50,000 years before
Clearly
Jesus.
Clearly, there's time travel.
So Ramses III.
The search for Spock.
he has a mortuary temple, a big temple commemorating all of his achievements, and also, you know, it's sort of a mausoleum.
That was discovered.
Or was recorded for the first time in the 19th century by the Franche, mm-hmm. The hieroglyphs describe what's known as the Battle of the Delta, which was an invasion by the Sea People of the Nile Delta.
Sea People is such a cool name.
I know, it's really cool.
I'm picturing Aquaman.
And Sea People is kind of a coinage. The French archaeologists that first kind of were able to read these hieroglyphics recognize that in Egyptian they were saying like, you know, people from the sea, and the French were like, you know.
So it is a Ramses era coinage.
Yeah. And on the temple, there are actually, in addition to hieroglyphics, actual like profiles, carved profiles of the prisoners that they took in the battles. So like little cartoons.
Does that mean they looked different than them ethnically somehow? They were like, check out these guys.
They had sort of headdresses and looks so that they could be identified as these groups. And all these invaders were also known as the Nine Bows. Bows meaning, you know, like
bow and arrow?
Bow and arrow. A group that were allied in some confederation, or were just 9 different groups that the Egyptians could kind of describe that all seemed to be attacking Egypt at the same time.
They grouped them together for some reason, possibly because they're an alliance. But all we know is there's 9 of them.
Yeah. Now, there were some groups that we know about, right? There's enough historic record from other sources, right? From Mycenaean sources and writings in Linear B, like the Luca their name is Luca.
Do they live on the second floor?
Some of them, who were not part of palace culture, and they're from Western Turkey, so the sort of islands, and you know the kingdom is described as large or small, but it's not a it's a tribal group.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a...
These guys are small potatoes.
Big man group who operate as pirates and are kind of against everybody. There's nobody that had a language and a palace culture that writes favorably about this group. And there's also...
Maybe they were just getting bullied. Maybe they were like cool outsiders.
Well, they were cool outsiders in the sense that they came and...
From outside.
And bullied. I mean, and there was another group, the Karkia, who were also kind of a chief-led group, not one that was particularly, there wasn't a central administration. It is a group, but they're acting kind of like Vikings, you know, like they each have a tough guy.
The criminal bands.
And as you can imagine, the infrastructure and the organization that is required of a palace culture, and you know, we've seen this over many times in history. If you're fighting with an army and you're funding an army, you're actually kind of vulnerable to small bands of guerrillas. This was, you know, the U.S. experience in Vietnam. Yes,
this continues today.
I mean, we see it all. This is what's happening in Bougainville.
So even though Egypt might have had a great army against the Hittites, it doesn't mean they're invulnerable to pirates?
Right. And a lot of these changes in technology that comes with casting bronze and the proto-Iron Age, you know, there was a large... chariot style of battle, big armies meeting on open plains, fighting with the aristocrats in chariots. But really, if you think about it, the spear was an invention.
Somebody had to invent a spear.
And the spear, in order for spears to be effective in battle, there need to be a lot of spears.
You think it would be an early invention, though? We've got the stick. We've got the knife. At some point, somebody's going to be like, you know. Maybe the first guy put the knife on the back of the spear, of the stick, and somebody else is like, no, wait, switch it around.
But I think part of it is that the stick went from being something that you would use to kill a buffalo to being part of an organized system of war where you there's
gotta have strategies.
15-foot-long sticks with cast bronze tips being used in group maneuvers. And so, yeah, it's one thing to have a little, like a coastal outpost representing the Hittite government in absentia, any kind of colonial outpost. But they're only invulnerable if you are another culture that's part of this complicated balance of power who doesn't want to piss somebody off because there's a navy behind it.
If you can just sail up the river, you can take all their stuff.
That's right. Mm. But also described in some of these records are the Pelasets, who sort of are identified as a group from somewhere in the Aegean. Maybe they later become the Philistines.
Hmm.
Maybe the Philistines are what rise up out of the destruction of this era.
It's so funny. This is pre-Philistines, you know, like pre-Bible, which you kind of think of as the beginning of things.
There's the Shekelesh, which if you look at some of these descriptions or some of these carvings, these cartoons, they sort of look like what later was discovered in Sicily. So how people from Sicily are part of this?
It does sound like Sicily, right? Shekelesh.
It's very unclear,
and they're already making trouble.
The Sherdans.
They just moved in next door.
The Sherdans look like they're from Sardinia.
Well, the names are giving it away
a little, right? And then there are other groups like the Weshesh.
I don't have a guess.
And the Ekwesh, and the Denyan. They don't look like anybody. There's no indication where they come
Maybe
from.
The good artist got let go or got malaria or something. And there's some new guy and he's like, they probably have hats.
But what's curious is that all of the peoples of all of these regions are known. They're known, they're referred to, they're part of these civilizations.
The records that are being kept imply that the reader knows who they are.
Yeah. Like
these guys, who we all know.
And the, you know, Minoans, Cretans, they all have palace culture. They're all part of this larger Mediterranean economy.
But they're not trading with these guys. So they know them as what, menaces?
Just as people from the sea.
As bummers, right? Because they don't, they never bring trade goods.
No, they're just coming to overrun.
Oh, wow.
And the Egyptians fight them through three pharaohs. There was Ramses III, and then there was a pharaoh by the name of Merneptah.
Okay.
Pharaoh Merneptah, who's between Ramses III and Ramses II.
You said there were going to be no proper names, and now you're like Shekelesh, Sardinians, Danandins, Tereptah.
These are words, or these are groups that aren't attested to anywhere else. I mean, they're not. The Egyptians didn't know where they were from.
We don't have their ruins.
No, they're throwing these names at us because presumably their captors or their captives are like, oh yeah, we're the Meshesh. But that's not. The Egyptians don't know where that is, and we've never scholarship points to where those things are, other than this kind of like, well, vaguely that might be this, but there's no other reason to think that the Sardinians are able to mount a seaborne army
on Egypt
that has the gall, literally, to to invade the Nile, right? The Egypt being arguably the most powerful nation.
Yeah, they must have been blown off course. If I'm in Sardinia, I wouldn't start with the Nile.
But the sea people are coming with women and children and all of the makings of a civilization.
Does that just mean a lot of their civilization is based on the sea? Like they have boats instead of palaces?
This is part of the Egyptian story. Although the sea people do then land armies and arrive as land-based armies in flanking motions.
Well, those are big navies they have then.
They are big navies.
They're not just a bunch of dopes in pirate ships.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The pharaoh Merneptah, who identified or was part of this battle against the nine bows, the nine sort of knowable anti-Egyptian groups. In one of his inscriptions, claims to have killed 6,000 of these invaders.
Sure you did.
And as proof of the numbers, all of the uncircumcised dead, he collected their penises as evidence of his victory.
He collected just their foreskins or the whole shebang?
The circumcised enemies. So this is indicating that this is a combination of circumcised and uncircumcised peoples. He didn't, for some reason, I'm not sure why, collect uncircumcised penises because who wants those?
You know, collectors tend to specialize.
That's right.
You know?
For them, he brought that, he collected their hands. So.
So he brought this back as proof that his campaign had been...
Yeah, like here's a big pile of hands and penises.
I have to think he could not have done it single-handedly.
Or single-penistly. That's a Ken joke.
He probably did it single-penistly.
Maybe he did. And it's interesting, like circumcision is one of these practices that's kind of global. There are different cultures around the world, unconnected to one another.
They just discover the marvel of circumcision.
Who are just like, you know what? This is, we're looking for a rite.
I'm looking at a baby.
Let's see.
What could I trim?
You know, it's like, he's got to become a man at some point. Maybe when we snip off the end of his penis, that'll be the way.
I guess. I mean, it wouldn't be my first pitch, but.
So, I mean, there's no way to kind of say like, oh, well, the Semitic ones are the ones without right. the foreskin because there are people in Africa, there are people all over that are practicing this.
But they must arise from multiple places if he's facing both circumcised and uncircumcised warriors.
That's right. And so you would assume in the absence of an organized administrative palace culture, that it would be very difficult to put together a coalition of pirates that aren't even really united in their own peoples.
Yeah.
To form a massive seaborne invading army that comes with all of the makings of what appears to be not just a invasion, but a migration.
Yeah, not just a raid.
And this is also a period of migration. People are moving around. Groups are civilizations are kind of absorbed as they grow. They're sort of absorbing different groups. What had formerly been a very stable culture, a very stable archipelago of cultures, mm-hmm. Is sort of starting to come unraveled at the same time. But for 100 years or more than 100 years, in Western archaeological thinking, this period, the end of the late Bronze Age, this enormous cataclysm that happened in the space of 50 years, which is nothing at all, it was understood to be the result, the absolute single result of this mystery group of seaborne plague of humans that came.
Changed everything.
And
disappeared.
Ended up destroying all the major cities and cultures that represented the whole of civilization.
So they had successful campaigns. Egypt, despite losing a bunch of penises, these guys stuck it to Egypt even.
Yeah, not just Egypt, but, I mean, new scholarship suggests that the Trojan Wars happened immediately in the middle of this period,
so it could be
of destruction.
Could be related?
Hard to imagine that in this region, where Troy is at the very heart of it.
A big war story would not be related, right?
Yeah, and so the idea that Troy was destroyed by heroic Greeks is, probably a gradual evolution of that story.
By the Greeks
to kind of explain what is this would have been an epic song that survived hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And what this began, I mean, what happened in that 50 years is that all of civilization, as it was known, went away, including written language, including monumental architecture.
Wow.
Including art.
These guys did a good job.
Something happened that basically put everybody in the ancient West back to basically a village-based agrarian culture with no technology for all intents and purposes, that persisted for 500 years.
It's really a bad sign if you're worried about the John Roberts Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, part of what has always interested me about this story is that we grew up in a time when it seemed like an apocalypse loomed in the form of nuclear war. And now we're living in a time where everybody has apocalyptic thinking. A lot of people are worried about zombies, which are probably not actually a threat, but ecological and what we're seeing here in the States, which is ideological conflict.
Not just here, but yeah.
Not just here, right. It seems to be predicating at least the potential of a cataclysm, a great cataclysm, in fact, a cataclysm that we hope will never come.
We fear, but hope will never come.
And there's been quite a bit of recent pushback on the sea people as the exclusive harbingers of of the end of culture.
It always happens. You have some great story,
yeah,
and then you got six scholars who are like, it's not that simple.
Hey, wait a minute.
We also
man.
Have to consider agricultural change.
So recent records suggest that this was also a time of great drought.
Well, when you said there was migration, my first question was going to be like, was it climate?
Yeah, that's right.
And it was.
And, well, climate played a role, right? There are, you know, there are some scholars identify this as the period that Mesopotamia and the Middle East went from lushly forested, you know, very productive farms to being a dry climate.
Mm.
And so, you know, modern scholars will say, well, now wait just a moment. There are other factors. But most intriguingly, just recently, a man by the name of Joseph Tainter, who teaches at Utah State.
I would not have thought of that as a archaeological hotbed, but okay. No.
He's a boomer archaeologist and cultural writer. Has suggested alternately that a theory called general systems collapse.
What's GSC?
GSC is the theory that any society that becomes sufficiently complex becomes too complex to sustain, and that when you have a palace culture that requires multiple layers of administration, like innumerable hierarchies, whole systems of trade that are bound by technologies that, you know, are kind of resource dependent, and in particular the kind of like the way that palaces suck up all sort of economic produce and then redistribute it to their citizens, is a complexity that has a kind of what it results in is a kind of subsidization of energy. The energy that it takes to do all this.
Sure. Middle management.
Yeah. Does not actually pencil out.
Doesn't add anything to the GDP, we would say today.
Right.
That makes sense.
And that general the complexity of systems makes them very vulnerable to pirates and to just ultimately a tower that topples over under its own weight.
And our technological advances have allowed us to create systems that are, you know, by any measure, millions of times more complicated than anything anybody had in the late Bronze Age. But we might still be vulnerable to pirates, right? Like, is the next thing a massive computer incursion blackout, you know?
And that's the thing. I mean, we see when there are rolling blackouts in our electrical grid, we suddenly are conscious of all the ways in which we don't have some systems are redundant, but many aren't. And even
Texas will certainly fall before California,
right?
To the sea peoples,
right? They'll either all their pipes will freeze if it happens in winter, or they'll it'll be 120 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But what's astonishing is that all of this memory. This cultural memory, this technological memory, the written work, the art, it very quickly
does not survive the
just
collapse.
Went away.
Yeah,
and for the early days of the Bronze Age, or I'm sorry, the early days of the Iron Age, as the technology to work iron came on the scene, it was arriving. It was being spread through a kind of network of unconnected and disorganized, like basically Stone Age people who culturally, who now were getting this sort of new metal, but not really turning it into. They'd lost the ability to turn it into empire.
There was no continuity. It wasn't like right. Iron Age is a promotion from the Bronze Age. It's like coming out of a crater.
Right. And it was really a population explosion in Greece that resulted in, you know, what happened in Greece was that they developed the Greek alphabet and were then expanding outward and encountering all the remnants of these civilizations throughout the Middle East.
Right.
And, you know, there were some, like Egypt, obviously, although greatly diminished, was still, you know, still maintained.
It's still a country today. You got to give it to Egypt. That's not too right. many of these places from 6,000 years ago are still in the UN. We don't see the Shekelish or whatever.
But, you know, there are, if you think about like Assyria, which was a sort of like a massive empire in
Iraq.
Persia and Iraq, you know, their name survives in Syria. There's, you know, the Elam culture in Persia obviously endured, or, you know, the Persians endured as a separate kingdom. But it really wasn't until, I mean, because the Archaic Age then is this, the rise of Greece. And it's really not until the Classical Age that we get again monumental stone architecture, sophisticated art, and sophisticated government and a network.
So this is why we're doing Omnibus. We assume that once our general system collapse happens, somebody is going to reinvent magazines and Oreos.
Because we saw it again at the collapse of the Roman Empire and what we think of as, again, another 500-year-plus period where technology and art and literature are lost and have to be rediscovered by Europeans, you know, again, like, hey, wait a minute. Why were they able to do these beautiful statues and we're just carving two-dimensional cartoons?
Our statues suck.
Yeah.
Hey. I just made a mud pie.
None of us can read.
It's not the Colossus of Rhodes.
Why could they all do science?
Well, I mean, it's the fact that these guys are just a mystery origin, like, makes me want to solve it.
Right.
Like, do I have to be the one to first say aliens? Aliens.
A lot of...
Or time travelers.
Time travelers.
Because what's
Atlanteans.
What's a culture where about half the men are circumcised? Modern West.
There it is.
Modern day America.
It's got to be...
We know they're not a bunch of uncircumcised Scandinavians. If they're half and half, it's a bunch of American time travelers.
Yeah, and Canadians probably.
And Canadians. Yeah, I always include them.
Yeah,
asterisk. And Puerto Rico and Canada. Time traveling back to the ancient Mediterranean to make a ruckus.
Do you think that that's a thing in our immediate future, that when we invade or when we invent time travel, that a lot of us will want to go back to ancient Egypt?
To be pirates.
I could see why.
Yeah, like if you're going to go back to ancient Egypt, do you want to live there or do you want to conquer it? I mean, there's two kinds of people.
There are a lot of people who would go back to ancient Gaza just to like see if they could straighten it out. And yeah. There you go. That's how it all starts, right? So I have been thinking about this a lot lately, and I think the archaeological consensus now is that we'll never know who the Sea People were.
Aww.
There's just no, unless somebody uncovers another Rosetta Stone, which is like an epic interview with with nine representatives of the Sea People who are all like, okay, well, I'll tell you, we actually are from Sicily.
We started out with goats, but then there was this guy, and he thought, what if we had boats? Taking the letter G from their varsity sweater. And that concludes Sea Peoples, entry 1120.1K2248, certificate number 9795 in the Omnibus. Futurelings from the other side of our system's collapse, we're glad to hear that you're back and have discovered some way to listen to this. Please do not reinvent social media. It was bad. Only people in our very late social media age will remember, will know what I mean when I say we were at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick online. I'm thinking of switching to Instagram.
You are?
Yeah, but I'd have to like build an audience.
Well, yeah, I know. That's the problem. Nobody wants to leave the old social media because they have all the followers.
Well, nowadays I'm like, oh yeah, my publisher's going to want me to promote the book, or
yeah,
somebody's going to want me to like put in a plug for pancreatic cancer on the anniversary of Alex Trebek's death. You know, I've got all these things and I'm like, I don't have an outlet for that.
Do you go to Twitter on the reg?
Not very much. I was kind of interested this week. We're recording, 9 days after an assassination attempt and 4 days after a Democratic candidate turnover. We're now, it's probably weirder than 1968 at this point, right?
Let's think.
We just did a show premised on the idea that 1968 was weirder than this, but I don't know
anymore. There haven't been any successful assassinations of major political
figures.
Unless
that guy just wanted to take out an ear.
Right.
He's like, I hate Trump's right ear.
Maybe he's a time traveler and he's like, it's the ear.
Trump's right ear has the cancer cells that will spread. We need to end the plague.
Must excise the ear.
Got this radioactive bullet.
I think that 68 still takes the cake so far.
68 does have a sitting president bail, yeah, and it has two successful assassinations, yeah, at least. So.
But it also had the White Album. And we also were in like the first really protracted quagmire. I mean, you can't really call Korea a quagmire because they got out of there with a fake.
Hawkeye's always complaining, oh, they don't know what shape the table should be at Panmunjom. Look, Hawkeye, you're going to be home in 2 years. Just can it.
So, I mean, I do feel like, I mean, maybe if we put someone on the moon in the next year.
Isn't that going to happen? Project Artemis? That,
it does feel like.
We're just recapitulating the 60s.
Well, you know what? It's the weird cult of capitalists, like the weird cult of billionaires that separates us from them.
Yes. We have an asset they did not. Yeah,
that's right. We have a layer of crazy.
We have rich people that go to the gym.
Yeah.
They had rich people and they had gyms. But they never thought to combine them.
The rich people weren't that rich and the gyms right. weren't that gymmy.
Yeah, the gyms just, you know, smelled like boxers.
Yeah.
I meant the people, not the shorts, but I guess both, right?
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully I will never switch over to Instagram. But if I do, I apologize for not owning up to it. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com if you know who the Sea People are, or if you're a time traveler who took part in one of those invasions. You'll need to show us your severed hand or penis, and then we'll believe you. You could email us, or you could send us physical items through the mail, thanks to the U.S. Postal Service. By the way, there's a cool new Alex Trebek stamp to check out. I got to go to the unveiling ceremony. I emceed the ceremony where they revealed the stamp.
Oh, isn't that nice?
So, you know, every time there's a new stamp, like, there's Postal Service funds allocated to a nice unveiling ceremony that's open to the public.
Well, now wait, did you get paid for this? This seems like something you should do pro bono.
Well, of course I did it pro bono.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
We couldn't even upgrade to German chocolate cake because it wasn't in the post office's budget.
No!
We were told to have Alex's favorite cake.
Which was German chocolate?
Well, we talked to Jean Trebek and she said, well, he liked various cakes. He liked chocolate. He liked German chocolate. And we picked the one that was not an upcharge from the bakery. Which was chocolate.
Chocolate. Does German chocolate cake have coconut on it? Cocoa nuts?
It does.
Yeah. See, I don't like that.
Well, it's not German. It's it's named for like Hermann, the guy who invented it.
They had half of Bougainville.
That's right.
They
could have been shipping in cocoa nuts from New Guinea.
That was the other coconut revolution.
But they weren't. What if the Germans are the sea people? What if time traveling Bismarckian navies invaded Ramses era Egypt?
Not to be too phrenologist about it, but none of the cartoons really look very German.
No monocles.
That's right. No small pointy mustaches.
Maybe they're all wearing a monocle on the other eye and it's you know, hieroglyphic profiles.
But you would think if you were drawing a hieroglyphic that you'd include the monocle.
You'd move the monocle to the eye of the side you're drawing on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But what if the guy's like, nein!
Now leave the monocle where it is.
This is the good eye. Well, how did we get on that?
Who knows?
Physical items can be sent to P.O. Box 557. Oh, I plugged the stamp. That's why. So go pick up your Alex Trebek stamps if there's any left. But also use those stamps to send us things. P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Look for other futurelings online that you can, if you have actual anthropological, archaeological expertise, you can all get together and complain about this show or others online.
If somebody wants to say that the nine bows were something else, just keep it to yourself. I don't want to hear it.
Unless one of you has the Dial of Destiny, which allows archaeologists to travel back in time to the period they're studying, just shut up.
I'm sure there's somebody out there, one of our listeners, who's like, hey, don't joke about Trump's ear. I bet there's one. There might be 1,000.
Well, which side are they on? Are they like, don't joke about that, I'm a supporter of his and that was an assassination attempt? Or is it like, don't minimize Trump by joking about his ear bandage?
I don't know. I don't know the last time you actually read the comments on anything you posted, but there's always somebody that says, don't joke about
slash. We need you two to get together. We need the world's most passionate defender of ex-President Trump to get together with somebody who hates him, but all think you shouldn't joke about his assassination. And you guys need to team up and take us out like the Sea Peoples.
In the futureling communities, they spend so much work trying to stop exactly that kind of conversation. Not stop, just like get ahead of. Like, let's not post about Trump's ear. Let's go back to mail trucks and Alex Trebek stamps.
We did that show about Mussolini's nose.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I think it got narrowly not shot.
There are fewer Mussolini defenders, I think, now than there are, say, for instance,
it's the passage Trump's of time. Defenders. We'll just wait till Trump is effectively Mussolini, which is, we're probably like 6 months away.
Hey.
Hey.
No, I support the Democratic nominee, and I think that most people do. Take that.
most people do. I think that the polls show that is true, but it's closer than you would think or like.
Yeah, yeah, I'm afraid.
So find your fellow futurelings online. Find one across the aisle to get mad at us with. And then, after you've exercised all your demons by yelling at us, you can think, but you know what? They're actually good eggs.
Who? Us? Us. Yeah, for sure.
Putting together a pretty... pretty respectable podcast on a shoestring.
If you knew us, you would like us.
On a shoestring.
I mean, you do know us for all intents and purposes.
They think they do.
If you like were trying to either loan us money or get us to loan you money, you might feel like, eh, those guys.
They don't know that I had hummus sitting in front of me this whole time and was not eating it. So, you know.
Now they know.
They have a parasocial social relationship. People could see me eating hummus.
But here's the thing.
Parasocial people can only hear it.
Here's the thing I know about you. That is hummus that you got on an airplane that you were like, oh, I didn't want to eat this on the plane, but I'm going to bring it to Omnibus. And it's literally free.
It's even worse.
Hummus.
I was in coach and they were like, you get a free meal because you have the status, but you're in coach for some reason. And I was like, okay, but I'm not hungry. So... you know, the airline forced me to take this.
Right. But rather than leave it or deny it, you were like, yeah, I'll take that, put it in my bag and eat it later.
I don't want to waste hummus.
So crazy.
Do you feel like you're pro wasting hummus?
No, but wouldn't giving it back to them to serve to someone else be not wasting it?
I feel like I earned it.
Yeah. See?
This is meritorious hummus.
See? I mean, I would.
But because, as I showed you, because of gluten-free people, I'm eating hummus on chips made out of hummus.
Oh, weird.
I mean, I don't get pita chips in a world of celiac.
You get
hummus chips? Hummus on hummus.
It's basically chickpea-based
chickpea chips. Goo on chickpea patty. This is what it's what we'll be eating after the apocalypse.
I'm basically. Sure it is. Do you think you're able to grow chickpeas where you live?
I don't know anything about do they look like peanuts? What do chickpeas even look like? Is it a vine?
That's a good question. What do chickpeas?
Why do we not know this? Are they in a pod?
It does seem like something we should know just to identify food after the apocalypse.
We used to call them garbanzo beans when I was a kid. I don't know when they got de-Italianated.
Well, yeah.
So I imagine them as growing on like a bean-like vine up the side of a Tuscan villa. Am I close?
How to grow and harvest chickpeas. They do kind of look like peanuts. You know what they look like? They look like edamame. Except with only one bean instead of two beans. Boy, these are hilarious little plants. You actually have to harvest each garbanzo bean.
Really?
Yeah.
It's its own little seedling?
They each hang down from the plant, so you would have to
like
go...
Like cherries?
Yeah, you'd have to go pick them like strawberries.
I'm imagining a tree, a big tree, but instead of being full of cherries, it's full of chickpeas.
And then you have to shell them... Boy, this requires an entire...
How is this the basis of all these subsistence-level civilizations?
Well, and the thing is, like, garbanzo culture is the same culture that we're talking about here. Mediterranean culture, These are the things.
One of the nine bows? The garbanzos are invading.
These were probably originally cultivated by the Mycenaeans or by some other palace
culture. It shouldn't be called palace culture. It should be called chickpea culture.
Chickpea culture.
Because that's what everybody was eating. Everybody was chickpea eating.
Bump, bump, bump.
That's what it is. I think I never actually got to the end of that sentence, which is, we have a Patreon, and would it kill you to support it? Like, who else is talking about chickpeas for this long in your life? Go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and see all the benefits to your life you'll receive if you become a supporter.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived, and we're guessing now that it probably falls apart just because it's too complex to keep together. But if this entry, like all our possible entries, have I forgotten the script, may have been our final word.
You just seem like you could just do it. You could like look into my eyes and do it.
I can. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.